Well, I'm Chris Culpin. I was a school teacher, and I packed that up in 1986. I'm now a textbook writer. I run courses for teachers. And from 1997 to 2008, I was director of the school's history project.
Thank you. Please, can you tell me more about your own educational background, how you came into teaching history in 1969, and what you learned about teaching history in your early career?
Right, well, I had an orthodox, I guess, grammar school, single-sex grammar school education, which took me eventually to Cambridge. I hadn't a clue what I wanted to do, and I left Cambridge. But someone said, I did a history degree, I got a respectable 2-1. Someone said, why don't you go and teach? And I'd always been very fond of Norwich, so a job cropped up at Norwich School. So I went and taught there for 4 terms, because I couldn't think of anything else to do. And I quite liked it, but I'd always also been slightly intrigued by the world of business, which is what my father did. And at the time at Norwich School, I was the youngest member of staff by about 17 years. So I felt a bit, and all the gowns and the cathedral and stuff. So I quit that after 4 terms and went and worked in London in business as Boots leather goods buyer. And after about 3 weeks, I decided that I didn't want to do that really. But I was in London. It was 1967, 68, it was a great place to be, and so I decided to stay there for a year and take myself off and do a PGCE under my own steam, which you could do if you had supported yourself for 3 years. So I did another 18 months living on the King's Road in 1968 and went off to Sussex to do my PGCE. So I think I had to find my own route to it, really. The Sussex PGCE was extremely good. I chose it, not having been to Sussex, because of its system, which is very like the current system, but was very unusual at that time, of teaching for 3 days a week and being in university for 2 days a week. And I was very lucky that the history PGCE tutor was Willie Lamont, who helped to teach me to teach, and the monitoring system of a teacher tutor for those 3 days. I was extremely lucky in all cases. I went to Thomas Bennett Comprehensive School in Crawley, which was fantastic. I mean, this was the cutting edge. It's hard to imagine, as we in our sort of staid results chasing, playing safe world that we live now, just how adventurous a radical comprehensive school was in at that time. That's 1968-69 I did. A lovely guy called John Townsend was my teacher tutor. And I, by being at that same school from, November, but from the autumn through to June, meant that you had a consistency and a support, which the kind of block teaching practice, which was the norm at that time, didn't really give me. I was then quite lucky to get a job. I was, fancy free, really. I got a job in Devon at Exmouth School, which was the largest comprehensive in England at the time, with 2,400 students. Great place, again, to learn. There were 12 NQTs in the school the September I started. It was a time of huge excitement, and we really thought that the world was going to change. It was 1969, the world was going to change, it was going to be a better place, and we're going to be peace and love and better history, and I expected and hoped to be part of that movement.
What did you mean by better history? What was
I think it was a reaction. We all had a reaction to the O level and A level history that we had been taught, and to be fair, been very successful at, which was heavily based on factual recall. Remember, I'd taught it a bit and could see that while it was really an enormous test of memory rather than any ability to think. In 1971, I went to the HA conference at which John Fiennes and Jeanette Coltham launched their pair of pamphlets about educational objectives for the study of history. And that was significant for me. It was significant for a lot of people. It was part of the wind. I mean, it was not out of a clear blue sky. Back at Sussex in 68-9, we had discussed Brunner's taxonomy of objectives. And so we were looking to translate a wider range of thinking and learning skills from the academic thoughts of Brunner's taxonomy, Bloom's taxonomy, and Brunner's thinking about that, and Bloom's taxonomy, that's right, into history. And so we're looking for a wider range of questioning, introducing sources into history teaching. And my head of department at Exmouth was very keen to let that happen. There was another NQT in the department at the time, so we were able to work with each other, and it was all very exciting.
So were you developing your own materials along the lines of the Fiennes and Coltham idea?
Yes, only in lesson terms. Trying out different ideas of questioning, looking particularly, I suppose the move at that time was heavily into let's bring more sources into the classroom. And so right from what we now call year seven through to A level, there was much, I was bringing in written and pictorial sources. The head of department was very artistic and loved to use works of art and music in his teaching. So we were looking to see what happened when you put what we saw as the raw material of history in front of kids and ask them to think about not only what they said, what conclusions you might draw, who might have written this, what was their standpoint. And it was very interesting. And there were, I suppose, just beginning to be a few books, often of documents plus pictures, being published at the time that we were able to draw on.
Well, there were those Jackdaw pamphlets.
Yes, Jackdaws I never found particularly helpful. I did try, and indeed Willie made us do a document pack when we were at Sussex. But a lot of Jackdaws you pinned on the classroom notice board, and what else can you do with a picture of Francis Drake, really? I think it was... There was a move, some university departments were publishing stuff, Longmans are publishing document collections. There was a lovely publisher called History at Source, which was publishing A5 sized books of terrific source material. So it was about sources at that time.
Was that from the point of view of sources make pupils more interactive, you can do group work, discussion work, or was it from the point of view of sources make pupils think more historically?
I think both, probably the latter rather than the former. I think my lessons at that time were probably still very teacher based. I don't think the word interactive was part of my vocabulary at that time. It's very difficult when 40 years later, I'm still involved in the same work to know exactly what was I thinking when I was dealing with the same problems 40 years ago. But I don't think, although I did get students to work in groups and I did ask them, I would, if you'd asked me at that time, I think I would have said that history is a subject where your own conclusions and views are valid. But I think my priority would have been more the pedagogy of looking at source material. Though I did see it as a way of putting the initiative into the hands of students as well.
What drew you then into writing textbooks and other guidance?
Well, I then became head of department. Let me get the chronology of this right. Head of department very rapidly, 2 years. I did 2 years at Exmouth. Became head of department in a 13-18 school, and I suppose was developing my own material. There again, I think it must have been, that was 71-75. I think it must have been about that time, or as I moved on to my next job in 75, which was a deputy headship, that I was going to HA conferences and was asked to speak at some event or other in Kennington with John Slater, who was chief HMI at the time, about teaching average and below average ability students, as it happens. And I think there were some publishers' reps in the audience. And so someone in, yes, I think it was, it was Hart Davis initially, who'd gone to the wall long ago, and they passed me on to Granada Publishing, who were rapidly taken over by somebody else. But nevertheless, I did produce through what was a very tough year, 1980-81, writing a major textbook. I used to do a weekend writing and a weekend off for a year, in addition to being a deputy head of a school, and produced Making History. I think by that stage I was already a GCSE. Yes, I was already a CSE examiner and chief examiner and panel member, and had already, back in about 74, taken on teaching a very inventive modern world course that the AEB were offering for O level. And I think it's, you know, as this is the time the Schools History Project was beginning, it's important to make clear that it was not the only creature on the beach, really, at that time. There were other courses. There was this AEB O-Level, which I thought was terrific. It involved lots of personal research. It involved the completion of a log, what we now call the metacognition of your inquiry process. We didn't call it that then, but that will still crop up, and you'll still find that in A-Level, some recent A-Level syllabuses at the moment, and indeed new GCSEs. And that was, I can't give you its syllabus number, but Henry McIntosh at the AEB was, again, you know, something that the current world doesn't know, which is an adventurous, non-business educationist running an examination board. Not, of course, for profit, but to see how assessment could improve practice in a way that, you know, well, I mustn't sound like a grumpy old man, but, you know, there was a feeling of being part of a world of innovation in which exam boards were your friends, not someone you're trying to outwit.
Mm. So the...
And I did devise, actually, a Mode 3. Mode 3 is, again, a whole, you know, one of the jobs I did for the East Anglian CSE board was to vet Mode 3s, and saw an amazingly interesting courses coming through being devised by teachers. I worked out a Mode 3, and there's an article about it in a very early edition of Teaching History, which took really SHP approaches and applied them to the modern world course.
Was that also a feature of the adventurous modern world, the AEB modern world course, that it took some of the SHP approaches?
Yes, you wouldn't have called it that at the time, because all we were trying to do really was to broaden the range of the nature of assessment. We now might call those. There was more to new history than the School History Project, a lot more. I think that's very important. And this is not to decry the importance of SHP, which was, you know, very serious and properly evaluated and so on, but there was a lot going on both before and during the years when SHP started.
But you were aware of SHP at that time?
I was
well.
Just about aware. I think I would have gone to the launch conference in Suffolk, which would have been about 72-73, and I was very interested, and I was in touch with Aileen Plummer, one of the subject officers, but I didn't join at that time. I felt that the courses that we were offering were, you know, perfectly adventurous, and I was happy to to take part in those at CSE and O level, as it was a bipartite system.
The exam work, did you become involved in that because you wanted to find out more about the variety of approaches?
I could see very early on, I think, that if you wanted to change classroom practice, you've got to find good methods of assessment. And I became an examiner in 1972 when I'm still at it, because if you don't have good examinations, then whatever you try and devise is distorted by the assessment process. Always has been, even more now when teachers are under such pressure. But so that's why I became an examiner, really. CSE boards were very democratic institutions. They were teacher controlled. All this is just amazing to think, where we are now. So there was an interest, as I explained, in Mode 3 courses. And I still see people today, some of them senior positions, HMIs and so on, whose Mode 3 courses I helped to approve in sort of, 1974 or something or other.
Did it matter that there was such a variety? It must have been very difficult to compare standards between different Mode 3 syllabuses.
Yes, you're looking initially at the syllabus offered to us. So you're looking for, is there a comparable range of content? Are the assessment objectives, in line with what were laid down for criteria for assessment? And then at the end of that process, when the first candidates present themselves. And I think it's true that you can see there do exist standards. I suppose when I work with colleagues in exam boards and we sit round a table and look at scripts, and after all, there are a huge range of options in history papers now. You could be comparing crime and medicine, Nazi Germany and Elizabethan England in SHP. You could be comparing huge range of courses in options in other courses. So you have an idea of underlying the particular topic that you're doing, what qualities of mind have these students shown, can they support their thinking, what are the range of abilities that they're at. If you look at levels mark schemes, which is another huge and important innovation from the 70s and 80s, and I think an unknown, unsung part of SHP's contribution to examining actually was levels mark schemes. You find qualities being expressed generically, not understands everything there is to know about the beer hall putsch, but can explain why it happened, why it failed, what impact it had on the Nazi Party, whatever it is that the question's actually asking. So I think you can do it, and examiners do it all the time.
Mm. Yes, was it a sort of understood, common there was a common understanding of something which wasn't articulated, but Fines and Coulton, the origins of an attempt to articulate.
Yes, we were certainly trying to find, if you're going to invent new objectives and new questions, we had to find standards in those. I think that's what you're getting at, and I think that's true. The work of the project in developing levels was very important. There's another gang in here, and I was trying to get the chronology right, because Martin Booth at Cambridge set up a group that published a number of pamphlets. Have you run across this lot? There was Martin, Henry again, Sue Styles, Rosemary Rees, John Hamer, Joe Scott.
I've heard of them all in different contexts.
Well, we met on occasional Saturdays at the Cambridge University Department of Education and published a pamphlet on empathy, a pamphlet on causation, a pamphlet on evidence. I can't even remember what we called ourselves. I'll go and find one of the pamphlets and find out. But that too was an effort to find standards. If you are going to raise new goals, new directions for teaching and learning, and then you've got to do assessment. In fact, pretty well every person I mentioned in that list was an examiner as well as a teacher.
So how did you then come to be interested in Schools Council History Project?
Well, working for the East Anglian CSE Board, running courses that were, you know, new history, for want of a better word, at a date that I can't quite remember, the East Anglian Board decided to offer the project at CSE while the SUJB ran the O level. I think Dennis Schmilt did the chief examiner business and didn't want to do it anymore. And round about 1980-ish, I moved over from running my own Mode 3, and actually became a Mode 1, in fact, for the East Anglian Board to run the Schools History Project as the chief examiner with a good team and so forth. And at the same time, I was by then a deputy head, we appointed to the school. I was being very keen on the project, and more realising that this is where we had to go, really. Round about that time, I became a deputy head in 79. No, I didn't. Is that right? 75. That's right. 75. Became a deputy head in 75. I think it must have been about 79-80 when I took on the Schools History Project as chief examiner for CSE. And at the same time, as a deputy head, appointed a head of department for history at the school, who was going to introduce the project. She had been teaching it somewhere else in Southampton, I think, and so I, because I, you know, I did my load of teaching, taught the project as well. But this coincided, as I say, with writing a modern world textbook, which was published in 1984. So I wasn't kind of like a lot of people, I think, took the project on from the beginning and sort of rode it. I kind of almost drifted into it, really, from a very much shared goals and philosophy and aim and so on. But in those middle years of my career and the early years of the project, I was keen and interested and committed, but I wasn't an early adopter, as they say in fashion circles. And Suffolk was very well set up to adopt the project. As in many authorities, the local advisor was really important and powerful figure.
Thinking about just now, I'll put this back on. You were talking about SHP and how you drifted into it.
But yes.
I did wonder why SHP became the dominant influence in the
Yes.
field.
It's interesting that, isn't it? It was in a sense a much more national, powerful force. I'm talking about, you know, little Mode 3s cooked up by three teachers in Colchester one afternoon, and I don't know what happened to the AB World Powers course, but I think Henry moved on and that died. Yes, I think I was at the point of talking about the role of the local authority advisor, because certainly in Suffolk, and I think also in Cambridgeshire, Essex, probably Norfolk, certainly in East Anglia, the local authority advisor decided to really go for the project in a big way. The guy called David Penrose in Suffolk decided to promote this. He arranged meetings for schools that were taking on the course quite regularly, like once a month we'd have a twilight in the teachers' centre. Who remembers teachers' centres? It was very convenient, you know, you turn up, have a cup of tea, sit around, somewhere to go and develop materials. So it was well supported, and I think it would be true to say, I don't want to malign, and I know, talking to other teachers and advisors, that that was the case across large swathes of England. It perhaps accounts, it still accounts, here we are 20 years later, it still accounts for the heavy take-up of SHP in some areas and the non-existent take-up of SHP in other areas. I don't think there's an SHP school in Liverpool, for instance, so it didn't, you know, didn't particularly grab it. Very strong in other authorities, Derbyshire, East Anglia, I mentioned, Bristol, it did grab it. So I think that's why the project became the dominant force. Also, probably, I think John Slater, who I mentioned, Chief HMI, was very much connected with the project. I think very supportive of the project. I think Dennis's evaluation study, the existence of a national O-level and CSE examination, meant that by 80-81, you know, it was a powerful force for a national force at a level which other innovations, which I've talked about, were not in the same league, really. And as early as 85, exam boards and CSE boards were beginning to talk to each other about a common examination. And that led to a big discussion about what the objectives of this examination should be. And I was part of the long-running discussions between the London board that changes its name every 5 years, and the CSE board, and the London CSE board, the LREB, to put together a common examination. And we did the first exam, I think, in 85. It wasn't an SHP exam, but the need to get together and to discuss what are exams for and about, I think SHP played a big part in that. But really, the move that killed off everything else and left SHP standing tall was the introduction of GCSE and the discussions that led to that, which I think were 87. And the part that John Slater played in ensuring that, I mean, we were worried that the introduction of a new examination with a Thatcherite government and Keith Joseph as Education Secretary could lead us down a sort of very narrow back to our island story course, which some of us are, you know, wonder what may happen after the elections of May 2010. That didn't happen. I think John Slater was a powerful force in helping to persuade the government that they couldn't go back, and that a wider range of objectives reflecting the educational force of history rather than its the continuance of heritage and its role simply as holding on to the narrative of the island, helped to make GCSE a strong force either for SHP or for modern world, but with all sorts of things that came in with GCSE, like coursework, like levels of response marking. I remember going to all sorts of conferences trying to explain levels of response marking, once to a conference of geography examiners and a conference of RE examiners. And so I was involved with QCA in those initiatives.
So the idea of levels of response had never really been heard of in geography and RE, is that what you're suggesting? And so they got a history chap to come and talk about.
Yeah. And arose from, I think it arose from John Hamer's work. Certainly it arose from SHP, and John Hamer's work as chief examiner for paper 2 for the Schools History Project in its early days of with the SUJB. I wasn't actually party of those, so anything I say about that would be secondhand, but it was a brilliant and terrific conception of how to produce standards, which is that you write the mark scheme after you have examined several hundred scripts.
Was that paper two, the unseen paper?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
which I helped, I didn't set any, I set some of those, of course, for the CSE board. Great, they were, very good, you know.
In a sense that it leaves you much freer to disregard the content and just concentrate on the quality
yes.
of the thinking.
Yes.
And that allows you then
yeah,
to set standards.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I wanted to just, you mentioned Shemmelt's evaluation and its influence. Could you explain what you think the influence of that?
Yes, because I think for a strange and long drawn out number of years, you had a funny situation where there was a school's history project on the one hand with its wider range of objectives, and you had courses which were still ticking a fact as they ever had done, as when I took O-level a couple of decades earlier. I think what Dennis's evaluation study showed is that this wasn't rubbish. You know, this wasn't stuff that, you know, that people could just based on general brightness and IQ and literacy skills or something or other. He was able to prove that people who had done the course were better at explanations, better at evaluating sources, better at understanding historical thinking than people who hadn't. And I think that, that was really important for giving a respectability. I mean, there have been, over the years, lots of innovatory courses, but the big evaluation study, I think, gave it a strength to say, you know, you've got to take this seriously. Students on this course are able to do things which they can't do on more orthodox pre-GCSE courses.
And that then fed through to the orthodoxy underpinning the GCSE assessment.
I think it did, yes. Yeah.
Are there any other ways in which SHP influenced the development of GCSE?
Levels, objectives, coursework, really. Coursework has never been it's a vital part of the SHP course because of the local study and the modern world study. The other great course that runs throughout this period is modern world history. That course never really took on coursework in quite the same way. But I think the requirement to do coursework comes from an expectation, a revelation that students will do better in different circumstances to do the kind of work that you simply cannot do in a written examination against the clock.
Can I move on to the national curriculum, but just ask you first, you were deputy head in the early 80s. When did you move?
I packed up at the end of 86. It was. I mean, looking back on it now, I don't regard those 10 years as the happiest bits of my career, really. I think a deputy head is a tough job between the head on the one hand and the staff on the other. There was difficult industrial action in 83, 84, I think, which I found very difficult split loyalties. I had gone for a couple of headships and not got them for what I thought were not particularly good reasons. And I wasn't sure I wanted to be a head at that time. I'd published my first textbook and I was an examiner, and the kind of curriculum innovation that was happening with the introduction of GCSE, and I was running lots of courses for teachers by then, mainly about GCSE really, travelling the country and sleeping on people's sofas and things, I decided that I got my first royalty check, which was £180, and thought, well, with a bit of this and a bit of that and a helpful wife, I might try and do something else. So I packed up at Christmas 86.
And then you were a freelance textbook writer.
Yes, completely freelance and examiner and course provider, whatever you like to call it. Those are the three legs of my life, really, the textbooks, the courses and the examining.
So were you surprised to be invited to join the History
Yes,
Working
I was.
Group?
Oh, to join the History Working Group. Yes. Roger Hennessy had interviewed all sorts of people, including me. He came down to Taunton and we had a chat about this and that. And I wasn't part of the original group, remember, if you look at the lists. Yeah. And they decided, for reasons I don't quite understand really, they needed a writer to be part of their discussions, perhaps to fill out, you know, the texts, the ideas and so on that were, or maybe they just wanted another voice, I don't know. But I joined them probably after about 9 months. It was about early 89 I joined them.
What were you going to say you were surprised at when I started to ask you and you said, oh yes?
Well, I was surprised to be asked, really. I mean, why should I... I mean, I was also surprised to be asked to become director of the School's History Project 8 years later, but that's a different story. I mean, there were a random collection of people who devised that. Very interesting, lovely people, many of whom I'm still in touch with, one of whom I saw yesterday. I mean, it was very good quality discussion, and it was...
Well, I think you joined after the interim report had been published, didn't you? So there was all that press interest already going on.
I think I joined just before the interim, but maybe you could know the chronology better than me, really. I can't remember. Maybe it was just after the interim, yeah.
Yeah. And you were in the second round of meetings, which were obviously a bit pressured because there'd been such a lot of press interest, political interest.
Yeah.
Did that come through in the discussions, a sort of tension?
Well, I think Michael Saunders Watson was very good and very robust at not giving in to pressure. Roger Hennessy attended all meetings, who was chief HMI for history at that time, and was also, if anything, perhaps he was more... I mean, Michael owed nothing to nobody, really. You know, when you live in a castle and are being commander of a frigate, who cares, really? And he was very robust at keeping the politicians at arm's length. And, you know, someone would say something in the House, you know, such and such is going to be in. So Michael would start the next meeting by saying, well, I can assure you that such and such is not going to be in. So he was very robust at that. However, goodness knows what else went on. But I don't think we were subject to political interest, except for our own, you know, we're not stupid. And Roger and Michael obviously had to produce something that was acceptable. But there was no intervention. I think the nature of the curriculum that we produced, I think that's the kind of curriculum that you would have produced. And another body of people would have done much the same thing, I think, in 1989, 1990.
What were the major issues in your heads as you were grappling with the need to produce this curriculum?
Well, I think... the balance between British and international history was something that we argued long and hard over. And indeed, it should be said that by requiring a European and an international topic to be studied, we were going far beyond what most schools taught between 11 and 14 at that time. We were innovatory in that respect. And what we said about the nature of history and the spiral accumulation of skills and all that, I think what what that working group did was to move forward and away from the apparent dichotomy between, I talked about this division between, you know, old-fashioned courses that were memory based and new history courses, which would be caricatured as knowledge v skills. I mean, there is knowledge in the Schools History Project and there are skills in writing an old-fashioned O-level paper, but what the national curriculum did was to say, of course you need both. I think if you had asked me in my radical youth in about 1970, I would have said history is about skills and the content is neither here nor there. I remember discussing that with Martin Boo and all sorts of people at the time. By 1990, I think we could see that certain topics, certain approaches to content, I mean, it's still not a final, not an argument which has been put to rest yet, but that not all content is of equal value. There is perhaps a need for students to study certain things, certain events. But at the same time also to apply to them a wider range of skills and just to know the dates of all the kings and queens or something. So I think those are perhaps the two things that I think the first national curriculum ought to be given credit for, really. I know everyone loved to hate it, but really it didn't do any harm to history. The harm that has been done to history has come from the league tables and the inspections and the chasing results, not from a national curriculum.
When you say the harm to history, what sort of things?
Well,
are you,
I mean, we're now in September 2009, and I'm quite pessimistic about the position of history in schools today. And if you want me to move on to that, I think. We're at a stage where we know, I mean, the HA has recently, in the last week, published a report of a survey of schools in which history is not taught in Year 7. Integrated courses of dubious value are taught in Year 7. And in other schools, or sometimes in the same schools, people start GCSE courses in Year 9. In many schools, and in some schools, history finds it very difficult to persuade kids to sign up, or it is made very difficult for them. There are schools where if you're not likely to get an A to C in history, you're not allowed to do it. There are schools where kids are shunted onto BTEC and diploma courses because they're perceived as easier routes to getting 5 A to C's for the school. And I think the subject, whilst Ofsted reports that it's well taught, is widely in dead trouble because of the way that senior management in some schools are dealing with the subject.
Do you think a lot of that is a result of the increased flexibility that's been introduced into the national curriculum?
No, I think it's... I think that's the excuse. I mean, there is a national curriculum. I took part in the discussions. I think I was the only one who was there in 1989 and in 2007. There is a national curriculum. It's a demanding national curriculum. You need 3 years to teach it, of at least an hour a week, preferably 70 or 80 minutes a week. And a lot of children are being pitifully sold short in their history education in the innovations that I've just mentioned that are chipping away at Key Stage 3 history, and indeed at the numbers who are enabled to do. I mean, there are schools where you can't do history after the age of 14. You're supposed to offer it, I think, but it's schools find ways of offering it, and oh look, no one's taken it, so you know you don't teach it. And I think the Ofsted short inspection, which focuses on core subjects, means that very often history is yet again degraded. I suppose one thing, I don't think this was Kenneth Baker's fault, but by declaring some subjects to be core and other subjects to be foundation, he created a divide which has had huge serious effects for history, in that time, effort, money, priority of schools goes into core subjects, into Key Stage 3 results, Key Stage 2 results in primary schools, the introduction of the Literacy Hour in 1999 by David Blunkett. There was a little flourishing of history in primary schools from the introduction of the National Curriculum, which had a serious Key Stage 2 course, up to the introduction of the Literacy Hour, when all that went by the board, and Ofsted now report that history is done often a bit of project work in the afternoons for the odd afternoon a week. The thing that the dangers that history is in now, the problems that we have as a subject, the subject position within schools, as a serious subject within schools, are not the fault of the national curriculum,
but of other factors associated with education policy.
Yeah. When I haven't done a lot of this, but I've done one or two visits with the Council of Europe and with EuroClio to other countries, and it is the notion that history should occupy the insignificant part that it plays in many, many schools is just amazing to other countries, where it is along with math, science, and your core language, your native language, it is it's a very, very important subject, and they can't conceive otherwise. So the UK is really out on a limb in the insignificance. And I think it's not widely known. I think we suffer from quite a bad, I think education suffers from being badly reported. I don't think it is widely reported what the situation that I've just described. And I can't give you, no one can give you. I mean, I've asked QCA, Ofsted, and the department, do they know how many schools are doing a two-year GCSE? Do they know how many schools don't teach history in year seven? Do they know how many schools don't offer history to all their pupils at 14? And they don't, because the flexibility is leading to a non-accountability, and the entitlement which the national curriculum did insist on, and if you're going to have a national curriculum, then I would support to a decent history education. If you have a situation where a child is in primary school, certainly not taught by a historian, someone who may not have done history themselves since they were 14, it's no part of a primary school teacher's training to do some history, so that could be a long way back. Year six is heavily devoted to getting good SAT results, and I think you just need to say that, because it is. I've had two children through this, and as I'm saying, Key Stage 3 is chopped down to 2 years, so you might get 2 years at an hour a week with a specialist history teacher, and it won't do. We've skipped a bit in time,
yes,
from national curriculum days, because of course the national curriculum was revised twice before the big revision of 2007, and it probably needed to be. I think we were told that we couldn't legislate for how much time schools should give history. I think that's probably right. But the tendency for any group of people gathered round a table to stick more history in than any possible school could possibly teach is all. I've sat in enough meetings of teachers to recognise that any six history teachers will give you a national curriculum that would require a day a week to teach, and we're never going to get that. So we were no worse than than any other group, I think, by producing too much. And as I say, we did at least insist that they had to do some European history and some non-British history, and that changed the curriculum for young people.
When I spoke to Dennis Schemmelt, he said he regarded the national curriculum as a stopping point in the development of history teaching. What is your view on that? Has it stopped development of the progressive development of teaching?
Well, I suppose the national curriculum was accompanied by these other more maleficent features that I'm talking about, really. If we had just had a national curriculum and no SATs and no core foundation split and no league tables and no measuring schools on 5As to Cs, then I wouldn't. I think that's Dennis is guilty of what he would call monocausality there, and I don't think that was particularly a stopping. I mean, it depends what your view of history teaching was before, but it certainly prevented the small minority of teachers who were keen to devise their own courses, use their own materials. I suppose in that sense he's right. There was obviously an immediately greater uniformity of content. But looking on it now, certainly the early 90s were quite extraordinary in terms of teachers thinking that they had now to teach a very conventional curriculum. This was seen in the extraordinary rush for textbooks, which obviously I was involved in. Teachers who hadn't really used, I mean, history teachers are very selective in the textbooks they use. They pinch a bit here and they do a page there and they photocopy a couple of pages here. But suddenly, I think because there hadn't been a national curriculum and it was a legislated order, felt that they, my God, what am I going to do? If I teach from this textbook, you know, when the inspector calls, I'd be able to say, look, you know, I'm doing it because it's been cooked up by somebody else. So there was people were scared. I think Colin Shepherd, who was running the Schools History Project at that time, deserves a huge credit for producing a set of textbooks, the SHP books, Contrast and Connections, Peace and War, and the third one, which maintained a questioning, source-based approach to teaching, and they were the best-selling textbooks of the 90s. Still are, you know, they're still selling. First one came out probably 1991, still. And I was doing rival publications at the time, but there was SHP books for. And I think the project and Colin and the project as an institution, as opposed to a state of mind, and that's a difference we must talk about a bit, deserves credit for maintaining quality history teaching. And I think what's happened since then, and goodness me, it's a long time, isn't it? The revision of 95, the revision of 2000, the flexibility of the recent national curriculum means that a whole new generation of young history teachers are doing terrifically. You only got to read the pages of Teaching History to recognise that certainly in the last 10 years, perhaps since 2000, 8 or 9 years, there is as much creativity in history teaching as there ever was. And we don't know, Dennis and I don't know. I get there was a lot of very conventional history teaching before the national curriculum. Maybe it was a stopping point, but I think it was a temporary one. It's not on its own responsible for the worst problems that we suffer from.
It's a good point to move on to your directorship of Schools History Project, which you started in 1997. And what drew you to take up that post?
Well, to my mind, it is the most desirable job in history teaching. I had once thought of being at HMI, but they had become, the enforcers of the judgments that I wasn't very keen on making. They were once a really respected, interesting, innovative body, and I think they lost that, you know, the work of the work of Woodhead, and turned that body into someone who, a group of people who don't have the confidence of teachers anymore. So I didn't want to do that. Local authority advisors, well, I was quite happy being self-employed, really. Local authority advisors were axed left, right and centre. I think there's now only about, from a time when probably most of the, how many are there, 120 local authorities in England, most of them had a history or a humanities advisor. I think it's now down to about 35, and some of those are advisors for about 40 different things, of which history is just one. I like what happened was that Colin had left the school's history project, Trinity and All Saints, and there was a gap, and the college was wondering whether to continue, and was in consultation with John Hamer, who either was or had been chief inspector for history. Anyway, John rang me up one night here and said, would you like to take it on? Point five of a job. And point five of a job is fine. You know, it's good. In financial terms, it gave me a bit of security, which a freelance doesn't have. But much more important than that, it's the job to have, really. It's being in charge of the most important innovation, history teaching, in my teaching lifetime. It gave me a way into a community of teachers whose values I share, I was a bit startled and nervous, of course, because of my illustrious predecessors, but I was thrilled to take it on, really.
What did you see as the main challenges when you took it on?
To continue, there'd been a gap between Colin and my taking it on. There was the threat from the national curriculum. There were all sorts of innovations which I felt the project should be taking on: new bits of curriculum, new technology, new textbooks and resources and so on. So I felt that was what I wanted to bring to it, really, to make the project continue to be, because it certainly had been, a respected force within the history teaching profession, and to support the work of all those history teachers out there who saw themselves, who do see themselves as SHP teachers, even if they maybe only teach Key Stage 3. They're either teachers of the GCSE course, or they're users of SHP textbooks, or they just have an attitude of mind. I mean, I talk to heads who don't teach a history lesson from one year to the next, and they say, oh yeah, I was an SHP teacher. So it's part of a state of mind. It was because of the way it grew up as askance, a slant from the mainstream. You know, it had to start from nothing in a world which was full of traditional O-levels. And people of my generation took it on as that novelty. I wanted to be, it was the top job in that world.
Of course, it was novel when you took it on in the early 80s, but by the late 1990s, it could be seen as fairly mainstream. So what did you want to do to, if you like, revivify it?
I didn't feel it needed reviving, to be honest. It needed supporting and enlivening, and I do see that as the role of the project, really. To be lively and a voice for history, to be a forum where teachers can swap ideas and teaching attitudes. I didn't see the project as in any way under threat, and I don't think it is, any more than history as a whole is. I think one angle that I did develop, perhaps because of my interest, was and I didn't intend this, but it kind of came about really, was making close links with government, making it a voice for history rather than for a particular curriculum within history.
Mm. I think the HA calls itself the voice for history.
They do, and of course they are. They you know, they get on that way. But I did set up a meeting with Charles Clark, he was Secretary of State for Education. I've been part of meetings with Lord Adonis and Jim Knight, and I felt I don't talk about the HA, but I felt there is a unity of view that the Schools History Project represents, if only perhaps because of that point five, that there's a point of which rapidly became, we haven't talked about Ian Dawson's role in all this really, but rapidly became a a point four for me and a point two for Ian, and it meant there's a consistency of view, both, you know, between the two of us, between the people we work with, the group of fellows who were set up in 1997 at that time, which, with the best will in the world, the HA can't do. I mean, it speaks for higher education, it speaks for people in lay people in society keen on history. The Education Committee works hard to do a voice for it, and their recent report is good. It is a voice for history, but I think your voice is as good as the views that you put forward, really.
And when you were meeting with Charles Clark and other ministers, were there particular issues that you'd gone to see them about, or was it simply to make sure they were aware of the agenda?
I think already, whenever Charles Clark was Secretary of State, which must have been 5 or 6 years ago now, there were concerns about the position of history, and he had concerns because, as I mentioned, I think we suffer badly from an ill-informed press. Actually, the only history reporting that gets hits the headlines is often incredibly ill-informed. Even a programme like Today will wheel out people who have no connection with history teaching in schools. The last interview about school history teaching, that the voice, there was a teacher on the one hand and the other voice on the other hand was Roy Strong. Well, I don't know when Roy Strong was last in a school, but his arguments made it rapidly clear that he hadn't really found out what was going on in school apart from reading a newspaper in the 1980s. So it's not well reported, and I suppose ministers need information. And I was coming from, rooted in schools and teachers and so on. The meetings have rather petered out. As ministers, I don't know, got their own agenda, and it became, it was intended to be a kind of question and answer, and the more recent meetings became much more ministers telling us what we should be doing, at which point, there seemed to be little point in. Charles listened. I've got a great deal of time for Charles Clark as a minister. He listened and was very interested, and we were going on very well. And actually, he put money forward for a little bit of work that Ian Dawson and I did on chronology. We wrote a scheme of work for QCA, and he paid for us to have a few days. A tiny thing, but showed. I mean, Charles was interested in history. He did A-level history. Lord Adonis felt more at home with the trouble with the meetings became SHP plus HA, and with the best will in the world, HA therefore brought along four or five heavyweight academics, and we started discussing history at university. And Adonis obviously felt much happier talking to those people than talking to scruffy school teachers like me. And Jim Knight gave us a lecture on how good diplomas are. So that was the end of that. But anyway, I think it meant that the project had a national reputation and standing, which has been important. I think it's been important and worthwhile.
So when you were putting forward those views to ministers, you see yourself as representing all the teachers who do SHP?
Well, we're not a membership organisation. They don't pay any fees. No, I think it was more at the level of information, really. The group called the Fellows, a group of six or seven people who were initially set up in 1977 to give me a bit of support, really. We met once a year, but also were able to consult regularly. So I think I represented, and they were a group of people who supported SHP, but also had a view about the importance of history in the curriculum. So I think I was speaking with knowledge from them, advisors, examiners, HMIs, teachers. And through the conference and through the inset that I do, I probably do 10, 15 days a year with bunches of teachers. And I visit schools, working with schools. So I think I have good rootedness. I think, of course, it's a selective bunch. I mean, it's people who are keen enough to want to come on a day's inset or to invite me to come to their schools. I don't get invited to the kind of schools where history is has been removed from the curriculum. So perhaps it's slightly self-selected, but I think over those years I do have a sense of the state of the nation's history.
Yes, you're implying that those contacts are two-way, that you're giving information to them, but they're also feeding back how things are going on in their schools to
Definitely.
You, and that SHP is in some sense.
It's difficult because it's not a proper survey, but as I've explained, I mean, even Ofsted can't tell us how many two-year Key Stage 3s there are. So when I hear a lot of teachers tell me that the head has waltzed in one day and told them that Year 9 doesn't exist anymore for them, if it's half a dozen schools tell me that, then maybe they're not the only ones.
Mm. In the early days of SHP, a lot of curriculum development, materials development was done. Now, I presume less is done, although Ian's still Director of
Publications.
So what role does that play in?
Yes. The project has always produced books, in the first case, because if you're going to teach, unorthodox bits of history, like medicine and American West, you need books to do it. And then later, the project recognise if you wanted to get its ideas across, you've got to produce your own materials. And so it's like assessment, really. If you can't get the exams right, your course is sunk, and if you haven't got the resources, no one's going to teach it. So I think Ian and I share a belief that it is through our publications that we do our curriculum innovation now. There's the importance of the Contrast and Connection series that I mentioned. I think the series that we've produced together in the last 10 years do mark, curriculum innovation in Key Stage 3 A level and GCSE now. I mean, we don't just publish for the GCSE Schools History Project course at all. A lot of the stuff is Key Stage 3 publishing, but also tremendous A-level textbook publishing as well. So the books represent our curriculum work now.
And are there younger teachers like you were coming through?
Well, we're very concerned, and we all, I'm aware in this conversation of the chronology of my own career and of loads like me who had the same, more or less, some very similar experiences. We are concerned. We have now, the fellows don't meet, a wider group, a younger group of people meet. We have some new publications planned involving a string of new, much, much younger teachers who are involved in these consultations. So we're very aware of the need to involve. I suppose our route to finding out who these are is teaching history, the journal Teaching History, and the fantastic job that Christine did in turning that from being a very turgid read into being a must read for any history teacher. And many of the people who I, yes, another route is through the workshops I get people to do at the conference. Of course, to do a 1.5 hour workshop to a very friendly audience is a first step for someone. And I hear about people from contacts, I meet them myself. HMI friends will say, look, you know, I've just been to such a school, saw a couple of fantastic lessons, you might like to invite them to do a workshop. And they do that, and then perhaps you'd like to help us write a book. And so we are very aware of the need for young to bring young people in to get involved with the project. And Michael, since he took over a year ago, has been rightly, I think, concerned to define the project, and so that we're not just inviting people to help us write the odd book. We're really asking them to come on board an enterprise that started in 1971.
That relates to the issue you were mentioning earlier about the difference between a state of mind or a way of thinking,
yes,
and an organisation.
Yes.
We talked more about the organisation.
The organisation is tiny, isn't it? It's 0.6 of a person. That's all it is since the school's council ended in
1984.
So that's 25 years. We've had to keep going on a shoestring, really. But through the exams, and on the whole a good relationship with the exam boards, the institution has kept in touch with a vast number of people. The project, I mean, you know, we're pleased with a conference of 250 history teachers, which sounds a lot, but actually, you know, there are a lot more history teachers than that, aren't there? But you do go around the place and meet people who clearly see themselves as unpaid up members of a non-existent, invisible club, really. And it's that community which I think it's very important, this, and it's something that governments don't recognise existence of. And I don't know if it exists in other subjects, really, but teachers learn a lot from each other, and they meet through websites now, through chat rooms, but through conferences, one day in set, and so on. I think people who've come to talk to us from other disciplines have talked about the community of history teachers as being unlike what exists among other subjects, even when there are powerful subject associations like the GA and ASE and so on. I think perhaps because it's a group who see themselves as slightly not mainstream.
Still.
Yeah. Well, it's still, you know, whatever it is, a minority GCSE, you know.
Although some would argue.
And very state schools, I think. There are very, very few public schools do the School Test Tube Project GCSE course, they may use our textbooks, either at Key Stage 3 or A level. But I don't know why. Well, you can speculate, can't you? But so it's probably 95-97% a state school group and take up of the course.
Thank you. I wanted to just finish off with a question that I put down about technology, because obviously in developing textbooks you're aware of the fact that this has moved into the realm of the electronic materials. Yeah. Books. I mean, yeah. How do you think that new technologies are affecting the teaching of history, in particular the development of new materials?
Well, there are obviously huge possibilities, and I think it's only now, 2007-08 really, that the new technology has really been useful. If anything, the first shift towards PowerPoint and CD-ROMs and so on was could be seen, I think, as retrograde. It tended to refocus attention back on the teacher, who could do a sort of fantastic all singing, all dancing display, and the kids sat there open-mouthed. I think with our most recent series of textbooks for Key Stage 3, we have published interactive CDs to go with them that contain all sorts of activities that you can't do in a book, or you can't springboard from a textbook. So only now, really, is the kind of active learning that we want to promote finding its way into the new technology. Whether there will come a time when we don't produce books but we only produce CDs, yes, I think there probably will. When you can produce a picture, you know, on the wall 6 foot by 8 foot and touch the hot spots on it and make characters speak and push it around and add, you know, things that you just can't do in a book. And it's non-linearity, the fact that, you know, a book goes like this and is laid down in advance. It's laid down in advance some year before the first child sees it, is a restriction for textbooks. So I think we're just beginning a big revolution in the provision of resources. Now, having said that, the Year 8 textbook that was published in June has sold 13,000 copies since the beginning of June. So somebody's buying old-fashioned spine colour paper textbooks. And I, you know, that's clearly the case. So the I can remember, you know, 20 years ago we were told that textbooks were doomed and so on. And it is a ratchet effect, you know. The younger you are, probably, the more you're inclined to use IT, to use IT-based materials than textbooks. And more people become more IT literate in their teaching every year. So it will be a slow process. And as I say, there may come a time when we don't actually produce a book at all. We just produce an interactive CD. Okay. And that's fine, as long as it's interactive. But the first lot of technology, I think, if anything, set things back. They were sort of compilations of material. I think it's only recently that history teachers have got their hands on the technology rather than the technologists.
Thank you very much, Chris.